Victor?
Yeah?
You know what I need.
You need the funk.
I need the funk.
I'll bring you the funk.
Volume. Hello and welcome to the second episode of Match Volume. I'm Matt Levin.
And I'm Victor Figueroa.
And today on the show, well, first, Victor, do you want to explain to maybe people who are stumbling upon the podcast for the first time, even after our fantastic debut episode, what Match Volume is about?
Yes, Match Volume, it's an interviews podcast. It's a back and forth between one person and maybe two others, three others. The essential part about it is that we're interviewing a whole range of people, from the quirky to the experts to people who just have something interesting to talk about.
Yeah, somebody you've just always been curious about and you want to ask some questions of. Today on the show, we have three pieces. We're going to be talking to a formerly paralyzed NFL linebacker who recovered and is now walking again through his work with yoga and meditation.
I love yoga.
We'll also be listening to your interview, Victor.
Woo!
With the vice president, the self-described vice president of the Negro League Baseball Museum. But we're going to start today talking about Miss Vereen.
Vereen. Who's Miss Vereen? Why is she important?
So Miss Vereen, who I think I might be falling in love with, is a high school English teacher at Animo Inglewood Charter High School. And I was covering a different story for Annenberg Radio News, and I saw her, and I just immediately liked her. She was very much like the cool English teacher that you had in junior high or high school. She had like a red streak through her hair.
Ooh, like Rogue from X-Men?
Yes, exactly like Rogue from X-Men. A very literate Rogue from X-Men.
Nice.
So I struck up a conversation with her because I just knew she was going to be interesting, and she was. And I asked her, what's the most difficult part of your job? And she works in a charter high school where the majority of kids are on the federal government's free and reduced lunch program. So I was expecting to hear, you know, this is a low-income community. There's lots of kids who work after school, single-parent households. I was expecting to hear stuff like that. And she said, my kids don't read like I read.
What do you mean they don't read like her?
Well, let's take a listen.
Do you have any questions? You have, you're so organized, you don't even need to talk, huh? You're terrifying. This table terrifies me.
What's been the biggest challenge about teaching kids in the digital era?
As the years have gone by, I've found it more difficult to get kids to appreciate reading anything for a long period of time, whether it's self-chosen or something that as a teacher I have to give them as part of the canon or part of the curriculum.
What qualifies as a long period of time?
Well, it seems like it gets shorter and shorter every year. Yeah.
That's actually beautifully sort of balanced. So
you were kind of saying you had to reteach the kids how to read linearly, mm-hmm. Right? Tell me what you meant by that.
So I've had a theory for a while, and I'm looking forward to seeing some evidence of this being true, that kids now have forgotten how to read from top to bottom, left to right. And the reason I think this is true is because I watch them. I hand them a photocopy of a couple of pages of this. It's a complex text. It's real hard to get through. There are a ton of words on the page. Their eyes will go to the center of the page looking for the important information so they don't have to read the sentences. They don't start at the top and work their way across unless I remind them. They need to be reminded that to read each sentence is to create meaning as you read, rather than, and this is my theory, is that because they've stared at a screen for such a long time, and that screens and graphics and GUI interfaces are things that attract your attention in the center of your face. They don't, the bars, the right, the left, it could be in the center. The paragraph starts in the center of the screen. That's what my students do.
Yeah, of course. You guys, if you need to take pictures of your posters, please do so. Only one person can take home the draft poster, so if you want to take pictures, do that.
That almost seems like a superior skill set that they are growing up with that you know, their parents didn't have.
The scraping for information is superior? Is that what I get it because the result of being able to gather information is the difference between, like, okay, if you can learn to be a master pastry chef, that's kind of awesome, but just knowing how to feed yourself is what survival is. So these are both skills, and you can't, if you're only going to have one of those, obviously you're going to want to know how to feed yourself. I feel like gathering information and being able to find what you need in terms of a nonfiction world is probably more important than being able to read fiction, but it doesn't create a higher class of human beings. It's a terrible way to put it. I'm going to get fired. I looked around. There were a couple of kids who didn't have cell phones. And as I went in and talked to them specifically, and I always have a backup for that, I said, so you don't have a cell phone, Diana? And she's like, no. I'm like, have you ever had a cell phone? She's like, no, my parents won't let me have one. She goes, I have some technology. You know, I have an iPad and I use that sometimes. And then I started, that was the first period of the day. And by 2 days later, after I'd run through all my classes, it was really interesting. All the kids, I had two or three kids like that in every class. All of those kids are straight A students.
You see the differences since...
Is there something different about how they're digesting the information?
They're getting it a lot faster. And I think that they're not spending as much time working on the critical thinking that comes from taking things in slowly. I think they have a hard time stopping and thinking about what they just read and what it means.
So give me some examples of how you've seen a change in that over the past 10 years. Because that's terrifying, right?
It's terrifying. I didn't have to actually have to stop four or five times during a lecture and say, okay, everybody stop and think about the words I just said. Listening isn't as strong as it used to be. We want kids to be able to think. To be able to think, you have to take time. And kids just don't have a lot of time. There's something about how fast their world moves that makes it super strange for me to say, stop and think about that. That's super strange for them. Right? They're like quiet time, wait time, like this. Super uncomfortable.
Faster and easier. Whose writing is this?
Angelica's.
It's really nice writing. I wouldn't mind.
I am not as convinced maybe as some that it is like the end of civilization as we know it. It's in the end of literature as we know it, and the end of, you know, attention span. I hope not. I got a kid growing up in this world. So scared.
No, we don't want fancy fonts. Think about the purpose of the poster. At least not for the paragraphs.
Volume. All right. If I ever have a child, I am not letting my kid have a cell phone until he's at least, or she, 35.
That's the thing. If you don't give them the technology, one, they won't learn it, and two, they won't have no friends.
Complete outcast.
Yeah. They'll be able to read all of Pride and Prejudice, but they'll be in a log cabin in Montana alone.
They're going to be so literary, intelligent. They'll read all this series of unfortunate events.
I can't get through those anymore.
Yeah, neither can I.
I can only read the first two sentences, and
they'll be much better than I.
Then I'm back on Gawker. So you wouldn't give your kid a cell phone, but would you let your kid play football?
You know, I've thought about this, and no, they're just going to swim. That's the one thing I would let them. The thing about it, and now I recognize how crazy I was as a kid, where people don't realize that at any professional level, at any high level, you will always play injured. Injured doesn't mean broken or something like that. You're going to be sore every time you play. You're going to be not 100% every time you play, and it's hard to come back and do it again every day for practice and every game, knowing that you're not going to be 100% for quite some time.
Victor, you played football in high school, right?
Yeah.
What position did you play?
I played a cornerback.
Oh, you were a defensive back.
Yeah, I was fast. I wasn't quite tall enough, but I was fast.
The Richard Sherman of Annenberg.
Yeah, but he ain't got nothing on me.
No, with a bigger ego. Was there ever a point where you saw a hit or a collision that was so severe in the NFL or maybe even in high school where you said, oh God, I don't know whether I should be playing this game anymore?
I don't think I thought much about it during the time when the hit occurred. But now when I look back, it makes me reflect on times when I would hit someone or I would get hit and I would kind of get right back up, stumbling, and my head would be woozy. And I would just keep on playing. And I thought that was the normal thing. I thought sometimes you just get these hits and you just have to keep playing through them. But now I realize that maybe I shouldn't have kept on playing.
And for our next piece, we're speaking with someone who didn't get back up, at least not immediately, from a very severe hit in the NFL. Our reporter Megan Coyle caught up with Keith Mitchell, who was an all-pro linebacker while he was playing for the Jacksonville Jaguars. On a tackle, he fell and didn't get back up.
So tell me a little bit about the accident that really changed your life.
It was actually week 2, our home opener in Jacksonville. We were playing the Buffalo Bills, making a random tackle that I had done a million times in my life. And this tackle, I hit the guy. The running back was actually Travis Henry. I tackled him head first, anticipated the play, ended up on my back. After you make a big collision like that, you typically get up and celebrate with your teammates. But on this particular play, as I was telling myself to get up, my body didn't respond.
Brandon, we have a Jaguars player hurt on the field, and I think that's Keith Mitchell, and he looks out, Brian.
So what happened after that? They got you off the field, and then?
So as I was on the field, actually, they didn't move me for like probably 45 minutes. And, you know, the interesting thing is my thoughts as I was going through this, I was like, you know, this is embarrassing. And which is very interesting when you talk about the psyche of the athlete in that position of being, you know, there's no telling at that point. I didn't have any idea what I had done, you know, what type of damage I had done to my body. But nevertheless, I basically passed out, woke up the next morning in the hospital with the same feeling of numbness, the same feeling of uncertainty.
What got you into meditation and yoga?
I was diagnosed with a spinal contusion. I went to my second opinion, my doctor. He had this therapist, you know, come see me time to time. And through the period of her seeing me, she talked to me about conscious breathing and what that meant.
So what does that mean?
Conscious breathing for me was breathing from the diaphragm on the inhale. The diaphragm pushes down. On the exhale, it pushes up. And in that, there's an inheritance that we've been gifted to heal ourselves.
Wow. So that's how you healed yourself.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting because when you talk about the conditioning and how as an athlete, I had been trained in a sense of what's the playbook? You know, who's the opponent? And in this case, the playbook was, okay, conscious breathing, my playbook. Who's the opponent? The ailment that I'm suffering from right now. My only thought was in that place of just openness to be committed to it because, okay, I can take this. I can heal myself. Then I'm going to do it.
What are the benefits of mindful yoga specifically for football players?
Most football players, most athletes, most people in general don't have a mind practice. You see people training, you know, all the time where you got CrossFit, you got all this, but it's like, how are you developing your mind? So this is a process of understanding how I process information and make it applicable to myself.
What are you still working on?
What I'm still working on is just, you know, it's really just allowing myself to just develop and be. The KM59 care plan is a concept that through the Light Up Foundation, my charity, we've collaborated with the University of Rochester's medical group that we're going to take 250 veterans and 250 retired players and take them through a 3-year program to help them transition to life again after their sport or after their service. it's a revolution of change that's so needed. And it's so interesting because we were able to cross barriers, you know, through sports. You know, the men, you know, they can't deny in a sense of when I come to the approach and talk about yoga meditation, well, it's so different than you going to them and talking about yoga meditation, because they can say, well, you know, you're flexible because you're like, you're a girl, you're a gymnast and all that kind of stuff. But then when it comes to me, they don't have excuses. So we've been able to get really good connections that way.
Do you miss football?
Do I miss football? You know what? I miss my teammates, and it's so cool because through what we're up to, we get a chance to bring my teammates back in the picture.
So would you trade yoga for like 5 more years of football?
I wouldn't, because the dynamics of what we're actually creating here now goes way beyond. We're going to revolutionize how people perceive their healthcare. We're going to change the ideal of Western medicine. That's huge to hold this space of like, hey, I teach meditation, I teach yoga, but understanding what that, you know, what that means to me and not needing the validation of others in that sense. I think this is way more important than playing the game, again, which I love, but this is so much more fulfilling.
Wow. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, Victor, I'm about to do my SportsCenter anchor. Impression. I've always also wanted to do this.
Which anchor?
Ooh, I'm not gonna do a specific one.
Oh, are you just doing you?
I'm just doing me as a cliche SportsCenter segue.
So this is Matt imitating Matt as a SportsCenter anchor.
It's kind of meta. Oof. Okay, you ready?
All right, I'm ready.
3, 2, 1. That's a pro radio tip right there. From the gridiron to the diamond.
Is that
transitioning from football to baseball. I don't know. You don't watch as much sports as I do.
Hey, grr.
Victor, who do you think of when you think of like your typical baseball fan?
I usually think of kind of like this old white guy with gray hair who's just like, I remember when I was a kid and I used to come to the ballpark with my dad.
So George Bush, basically.
Yeah, I imagine tens of thousands of George Bushes in the stadium.
Sounds like a good time. What do you think of when you think of the typical baseball player?
I sort of think baseball is a hodgepodge of players. I mean, mostly white American males, but also Koreans, Japanese, a bunch of Caribbean players. Though, surprisingly, I actually don't think of African Americans that much, except maybe CC Sabathia, because I'm a Yankees fan, and Robinson Cano.
Yeah, you really don't think African-Americans like you think when you talk about the NFL or the NBA, but it didn't always used to be that way.
Yeah, even before Jackie Robinson, baseball was a big part of the lives of African-Americans. And I sat down with Raymond Doswell. He's the vice president of curatorial services at the Negro League Baseball Museum. It took me a while to remember that. He's basically the janitor slash umpire. His words, not mine.
Utility player.
Yeah, it's so-called utility man. And I asked him what exactly he was trying to convey through his museum.
Volume.
So tell me, what do you do at the museum, the Negro League Baseball Museum?
We strive to try to, as best we can, to tell the entire story of African-American baseball, which encompasses the integration of baseball, and of course, the pre-origins of what was called the Negro Leagues. It's not easy because it's not all out there. There weren't any official record books in the same way as Major League Baseball. It's a lot of oral history, some newspaper articles, stuff in people's attics and scrapbooks to try to pull all that together. So a lot of people like to compare Major League Baseball and these leagues and this whole history, but it's a pretty vast history. It's a challenge in that regard. And no, Major League Baseball did not keep track of all this. So there's not a whole lot of this at the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown and those kinds of things. They're scrambling to tell that story just as much as we are, and we're dedicated to the story.
When people walk into this museum, what are you hoping they take away from the experience?
One, that it was bigger than just the one or two players or teams that they knew about before. Two, these players and these team owners and the people who supported them had agency. They chose to play baseball. They chose to support baseball. It wasn't that they were relegated to have their own so-called minor or lesser league. Heck, they didn't have to play baseball. They could have done something else. So they built it. Did they want to play in the major league? Some of them did, certainly did. Should they have deserved the opportunity to at least try? Sure, but they couldn't, so they did their own thing. And that's empowerment. That's not something that one should feel bad about. Oh, it's just a shame that they didn't get a chance to play with Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. Well, it's maybe a shame that Gehrig and Ruth didn't get a chance to play with them on a regular basis. That's something I hope people get, and that segregation and racism is a sad circumstance. But here is something that was great that came out of it, and the people built that themselves.
Is there a particular story from the museum or in the museum that when people come, you make sure to show them?
We have a photograph in the museum. On the photo is a young man at a train station. This is in the 50s. No baseball in it. There's no baseball bats. He's at a train station. He's actually standing on the railroad tracks, and he's got his duffel bag next to him. He's a young man dressed in working class clothes, looking a little scared. The sun is in his eyes. He's squinting a little bit. But he looks strong. He looks firm, and he looks like he's ready to go. And then there's a letter. We have a copy of a letter accompanying it. And there's the two team officials, baseball team officials, who were discussing the recruitment of this young man to be a ball player. And in the letter, there's a line from one of the scouts, and it says, "I do think he will develop into a great player one of these days. I do think he will develop into a great player one of these days." Well, it turns out that young man went on from Mobile, Alabama, to play for a team called the Indianapolis Clowns. That's who was recruiting him. Played there in the summer, was a cross-handed hitting shortstop, who was quickly scooped up by the Milwaukee Braves system and would go on to play for the Milwaukee Atlanta Braves system and become the all-time home run leader, and that was Henry Aaron. And at the museum, we have a motto called Discover Greatness, and that's the moment when greatness is discovered.
So you're here today to kind of shed some more light on what Jackie Robinson did in his career. You mentioned earlier specifically steals and how he was a much more aggressive base runner than people give him credit for. I just want to know, is there something else you want people to know about Robinson that maybe they haven't known about him or just you want to shed some more light on?
Well, one of the things that I'm proposing is that this was one example of how athletes use their athletic performance as a form of social dissent. Robinson certainly used that as a platform to really push back against ideology that blacks didn't belong. Because in order for his integration in baseball to be successful, his general manager of the Dodgers, Branch Rickey, asked him and told him, you cannot fight back if people, you have to kind of hold your line. Even if you're right in responding, they won't see that. They'll only say that Robinson lost his cool and things like that. So how was he supposed to fight back? He fought back through performance.
You know, you're sharing all this history. Do you think the players today are thinking about this or at least like consider the steps that were taken?
Once they're exposed to it, I think your average baseball player today, if they don't get a chance to get exposed to the history of the game, they don't really think about it beyond maybe the history of major league ball players when the Latino players come in. And then they're surprised when they see Martin de Higo and Cristobal Torriente and players like that from Cuba and other places that, oh, I didn't know. You know, and they may have heard of these names in their childhood, and then they're making the connection. So once they get in and they see it, they get it. And then they have a great appreciation for it. But they've got to be exposed to it. So that's why we're here. We do traveling exhibits. And we try to make ourselves available to teach the history.
What do you take away from the game of baseball?
I know it's a little corny, but it's true. Like in the movie Field of Dreams, when the Terrence Mann character said, baseball marks the time. I can't do it, James Earl Jones, sorry. But but that's true. It's so true. Baseball really does mark the time. And everyone says that football is now becoming America's pastime. That's hogwash. Football is America's passion of the moment, but baseball continues to be America's pastime. And what I take away from it is really, truly the balance of teamwork and individual effort. And when folks are able to do their jobs and work as a team, things do work very well. And I encourage others to embrace it with your kids, embrace it with your family, and we'll always have something to talk about.
One more thing. You called yourself the janitor of the museum. Can you elaborate on that real quick?
Oh, well, I was kidding. Like I said, my title was Vice President of Curatorial Services, so maybe a better descriptor is I'm the umpire. When you're an umpire at a game, if you don't notice the umpire, then everything's going smoothly, then you're doing your job. And so if things are going smoothly and no one knows there's anything wrong in the museum or anything like that, then I've done my job. And as soon as I have to step in and be out front, then it's time for me to really truly go to work. But I try to keep things running smoothly.
That was janitor / umpire / vice president of curatorial services at the Negro League Baseball Museum, Raymond Doswell. And yeah, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you.
And with that, that ends our second episode of Match Volume.
Woohoo!
I want to thank our reporters, Megan Coyle, myself, Victor Figueroa, and I guess I'll thank Matt Levin.
I will also reluctantly thank myself.
Match Volume is a podcast of Annenberg Radio News and the Media Center at USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. So tune in next time for our third episode of Match Volume. That will be on the last week of March.
And for the third episode, we have a very special guest, Adnan from Serial. We'll confess that he did everything here. It's an exclusive. He just totally did it. He just did it. And he just tells us that he did it.
Yep, over and over again.
Yep.
So even though we just told you the point of our next podcast, still tune in.
Yeah. Thank you, Adnan.
Bye, everyone.
Volume.